Hello, this is the Angry GM, and you are listening to the Angry GM's mostly monthly live chat for the month of June in the year of 2024. And that was, I had no way to finish that sentence, and already we are screwed up. So much for my awesome starting delivery thing. Welcome, though. Welcome to the June Mostly Monthly Live Chat. Thank you, everybody, for coming and hanging out. I have Procellus the Hungry Metroid in the producer booth. He is producing. We have a lovely studio audience here. They all have faces for text chat. So this is it. Now I'm stumbling and don't know how to talk. So first of all, if this sounds a little different, that's because I'm using a different microphone, which is going to drive Ratter Crash crazy, who, by the way, I never credit him, and I have to start doing crediting better. So first of all, Procellus is the producer. And second of all, Ratter Crash is responsible for turning my crappy recorded audio into audio that is actually listenable to. So Ratter Crash does audio remastering, and he's going to have some extra work to do this weekend because I have changed my microphone setup. And if I sound different, that's why. And if I don't sound different, it's because he did a good job. Anyway, so let's start with newsiness stuff. Because I like to start just by talking about a couple of things that are going on right now. And the biggest bit of news is that I was totally on schedule and was cranking out feature articles on Wednesdays-ish the way I had promised, but I was at least doing one a month and then, or one a week, and then things kind of fell apart over the weekend or last week and into the weekend. And there's been a couple of different disruptions, but one of the big ones was utility work kept knocking out my power and internet, which makes it really hard to publish internet content. So I am catching up. I have not been sitting idle here in the dark. Actually I will talk about some of the stuff that I have been doing in the non-computer time, but there's also been a couple of other things that don't need to be discussed, just, you know, normal stuff, but, it's not going to spill into throwing me off for weeks and weeks and weeks. By the end of this week-ish, I'll be caught up, but I'll definitely be caught up by the beginning of next week sometime. I know I said I was going to get the next article out today. Didn't quite happen. Kind of close, but I couldn't quite pull it off. So it'll happen tomorrow for sure, though. It's probably going to be one of those record the proofread aloud and then hit publish right away kind of articles, but at least it'll be out there. And it is, in fact, a new true scenario designery article, even though that means I will be doing two in a row. Because what happened was So I launched True Scenario Design, as I don't know if I mentioned that in the last Mostly Monthly Live Chat, but I think I did because the last Mostly Monthly Live Chat did happen pretty near to the end of the month, and so it was just 2 weeks ago. But I have launched the True Scenario Designery series that everybody has been clamoring for so that I can disappoint them with that. And I launched it without actually having the best plan. Like, previously, I had outlined these true whatever-y series, at least so that I knew roughly how many articles I would need and what order I was going to address topics in. And True Game Mastery, that outline ended up being revised 3 or 4 times, and I added and moved things around, but at least I did have a plan and an outline. And True Campaign Managery did go a little bit off the rails. And so I'm trying to yank it kicking and screaming back onto the rails. But also, it's not the most fun series I have ever written, TBH, which is why I started doing True Scenario Designery. And while people really do like the True Campaign Managery stuff, I've gotten good responses on it. At the same token, it's not really gaming stuff. You know, it's more psychology and people management and shit like that. So I figured True Scenario Designery would be nice to bring out, but I didn't have the super greatest plan for it when I started. And then as a result of some necessary car service that had me stuck at a mechanic shop for most of my writing time for a day, I ended up outlining like feverishly three or four lessons and like the initial plan for True Scenario Designer. And I got really excited about it, and I'm really excited to launch the series. So now what I have to do is keep myself from just writing it every week, because I do still have to keep up with True Campaign Managery, and I have to insert one-off articles and things like that as well. So ultimately, my plan is to do one True Scenario Designery, or sometimes two a month, one True Campaign Managery article, or sometimes two a month, and one-off article, or sometimes none a month. And then there is the Angry Hacks thing. The Angry Hacks thing keeps getting stalled out. And there's a couple of reasons for that. And I've talked about some of the reasons before. But I have decided to just throw money at the problem. Because I think one of the things I mentioned previously was that I want the quality on the Angry Hacks to look good. It's not the mechanical design that's throwing me off, though it is a lot harder to write like actual just game content than it is to write the sort of bullshit that I normally write. You know, it's a very different writing style, and so that is a challenge in itself. But I wanted it to look good, look professional. I wanted, when you download the Angry Hacks, because they're going to be PDFs, not articles, and when you download them, I want them to be like, ooh, this is nice. This actually looks like somebody who took the time to actually make a good product here, kind of a thing. And while I was handling things like the layout and graphical design myself, it turns out that I kind of suck at it. I mean, I can sort of do it. So finally I did, and that was causing a problem because it was just not up to my standards, and I have ridiculous standards. The one thing that keeps me from delivering things more than anything else is my standards. I, you know, if I don't love what I do, it's like, okay, I just can't. So I have hired someone to take the layout and graphical design part of it off my plate, to basically just build a format, a custom format for Angry Games, specifically for Angry Hacks. It's a one and done thing. Once I have the format, I can just take the actual things that I've written, you know, take the hacks and just put them in there, and then spend 4 hours, you know, going through and formatting and cleaning it up. But I know how to do that stuff because that's easy. And then, bam, it'll look good. And now I don't have that excuse for not getting them out. The design is actually actively being worked on now. And it will be done by in a couple of weeks, which will allow me to put out the first Angry Hack at the end of July. And so then it will be one or two True Scenario Designery articles a month, one or two Campaign Managery articles a month, one Angry Hack a month, and then one maybe one-off article instead of doubling up on one of the other series a month, at least for the foreseeable future. And there is actually the possibility, depending on how things work out, that I may go to a four articles plus an Angry Hack a month setup. But that's at least 3 months away. Because I am still very much in the trying to put my schedule back together thing that I've been working on now for the better part of several months. But that's enough about that. Like, so that's the news. That's the, you know, that's the boring stuff. Another thing that I want to talk about tonight is something that I was asked about a couple of times over the previous months, and I kept kind of pushing it off. People do actually want updates on my home games. They want to know what I'm running and what's going on, and, you know, that's kind of a fun thing to talk about. So I want to take some time tonight to just, you know, let you know what I'm doing, and then in future live chats, I will make it a point to just tell you what's going on in my games and what awesome or terrible things I've run. And it's really fun to talk about this tonight, because last week I had two amazing sessions because I'm running two different games. So just to let everybody know, I am running two different campaigns. One is a weekly online game for a group of people that I've been running games for years now. They are an awesome group of people. I am currently running Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. The campaign is called Chain of Stars. It is a homebrew campaign because that's all I do is homebrew stuff. I just make my own material. Though we are, like, it's like set in Greyhawk, but not really Greyhawk. You know, where you just feel like the details of Greyhawk. Like, I use the gods and some of the history and the mythology and the cosmology, but, you know, the map is just, and here's some kingdom that's in some corner of Greyhawk or whatever. Who cares, right? I don't care how it fits into the world. It's just, you know, it's my Greyhawk. Okay. That campaign was originally started to be a limited run campaign because I was breaking my players' hearts. Because we kept starting new campaigns and then things would fall apart. They would peter out, scheduling people, or we would just, you know, run and run and run and run. And then I would hate 5th edition and say, I cannot do this anymore. I will literally claw my own eyes out if you make me keep running this system. Whatever it is, the normal things that disrupt the campaign. And so they finally said to me, very frankly, like, we love your games, because of course they love my games. I'm awesome. We love your games, but we don't get to finish, ever. You know, we've never had closure in a game, and it's, you know, we've now had a lot of games that don't come to closure. We want something that will finish. And I said, I hear you. So here's what I will do. I'm going to plot out an actual campaign beginning to end with a solid ending. Basically, 12 adventure campaign, with, you know, 10 to 12 adventures with little town bits in between the adventures, all plotted out, planned out very carefully. And the whole thing should take roughly 6 to 9 months based on things. So, yeah, that's been going on now for about a year. We're 2 adventures in. We're actually in an interlude between the 2nd and the 3rd adventure, and it's going really, really well. So the 2nd one is a recent game that I have just started. I shouldn't say I've just started it, because it's been kind of stuttery, and our schedule is very disjointed because of just availability issues. So we can only place twice a month, but we can't really maintain an every other week thing. It's more of, we have to set up when we can play at the start of the month and then schedule 2 sessions. Sometimes we only get 1, you know, and there's only 3 players. So if we have even 1 player who is not available, or if, and I have had a couple of emergencies in the last few months, as you all know, then all of the sudden we can be without a game for a month, which is really a pain in the ass, but you do what you can. And it's a new group of players. It's people that I didn't really know before I started running for them. And while it has been, like, technically 9 months, because of the whole disjointed schedule thing, I think with the actual campaign, we've only ended up having 5 sessions, and we did do a one-shot before then. And I'm really becoming friends with them. They're also a really good group of people, but they were strangers before. And this is in person, which is awesome. So, and we are playing Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 4th Edition. And again, it's a homebrewed campaign. It is set in the Warhammer universe, but only kinda, because I actually don't know anything about the Warhammer universe. I wanted to run the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay because I was more enamored by the mechanical system. And I don't have previous experience with Warhammer or 40K or the fighting or the war game or anything. Like, I have no connection to Warhammer at all, other than actually. So this is funny, but I did run the 3rd edition of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay for a few months. And I bought really into that system. That was published by Fantasy Flight Games. It is the edition that Warhammer fans do not speak of. It is the 4E of Warhammer. Okay. Sorry, Arthur. But it's the 4E of Warhammer is Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. Fantasy Flight Games did totally their own thing with it. They piled it up with cards and tokens and fiddly bits and little pieces that you had to assemble and stuff you had to flip and all sorts of stuff. It was awesome. The box of the core set was like 75 pounds of game. And it had this bizarre-ass dice mechanic that was based on all the dice. They have all the different shapes of dice that you would expect, but instead of numbers, the dice have crazy symbols on them. And you would build these pools of dice and roll them. And then depending on the combinations of the symbols, it would be like successes and failures and crits and misses, and also lucky things and unlucky things or stress or whatever. Interestingly enough, this system that was utterly reviled to the point where I may be the only person who ever bought it. It was so utterly reviled that it's just gone now and nobody speaks of it. But it did nonetheless provide the mechanical basis for all of Fantasy Flight's various Star Wars role-playing games. And there's a lot of elements that came from that. There's also a lot of elements that didn't. And like 4E for D&D, there were a lot of really interesting mechanical things that system did that just got lost because it was so hated. It's like, oh my God, we hate this system. Just throw it all out. Pretend we never heard of any of this, right? So, and now it will never be evolved on, which is kind of a shame. So anyway, so that has been my experience with Warhammer. But now I'm running Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 4th Edition, a campaign I have entitled Under the Wheel, because it's about two miserable peasants and an elvish seaman, which, because in Warhammer, you do random character generation, and it's really random, like really random. It's not like, okay, just roll your stats and then, you know, pick one of the eight classes or whatever it is. It's okay, there's 70 different careers in the world. Roll randomly to see which career you is. Congratulations, you're a goat herd, or you're a rat catcher, or you're a witch hunter, or you're a burgomeister. Okay, it's that much. So we ended up in the random rolling with a... basically, the lowest class that you can have. So we have someone who's just literally a peasant, a rural peasant, and their career is goat farmer or goat herd. They're a goat herd in this rural peasant village. And then we had one step up. We had another peasant, and he's a miner. So he, you know, whereas the one guy works with the village's herds, the other guy works in the village's mines, except he's not even qualified to work in the mines yet. He's so low on the mining spectrum that he's just go wander around and find valuable rocks. And if you find enough valuable rocks, we'll eventually let you work in the mines. He's a prospector. So that's great. And then we have a high elf from a merchant house who is a seaman, who is also so low on the spectrum of merchant sailing that he is not actually allowed on the ship yet. He's a landsman. So he works on the docks. He's a schlepper, you know. So this was what I had to build a campaign around. And it was an utter and complete disaster. And it has been an utter and complete disaster for me behind the table. Now, I don't want to talk, I'm not talking about the players here. Okay, for me, as the guy who had to build the campaign and run the thing, it has been an utter mess. And I only feel like I have just now found my footing. So as I keep doing these live chats each month, I'm going to start sharing stories from my games. I don't really have any stories to tell because there's another topic I want to talk about tonight. And because both of my games are recovering from lots of schedule disruption. But there is an aspect of this that makes it really hard to talk about my games. Okay. There's actually two aspects. Okay. The first is just that I can't give away any spoilers because in my two groups, there are at least some players who are members of this community and who read and listen to every word I put out. And so anything I let slip is going to ruin the game. And I can't be like, don't listen to the live chat, because people love the live chats, and who wouldn't, because I'm awesome and charismatic and fun. But so I have to be really, really careful about what I talk about. The other thing is that you have to be careful. So GMs know this. Now, if you're one of my players, just plug your ears for a second. Okay, because now the GMs have to talk. And I know some of you are GMs and you already know this, but just plug your ears anyway. Okay. All the GMs out there, we all know that no matter how much we love our players and how much fun our games are and how awesome our players are, the best things to talk about are those moments in the game where everything goes wrong. And that, you know, and, you know, then we have a good laugh. Right? The trouble is, sometimes you don't want your players to hear that. Because when you're just joking around about your game affectionately, sometimes the players will walk away thinking, is he making fun of us? Is he yelling at us through his podcast? What is going on here? So it's really, really tough. And I have to be really, really careful to get permission from my players. In fact, there is a story that I really want to share, and I did finally have to get permission from the player because it was totally charitably. It was, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going into overtime on the home game topic because I did get permission to share this story, and it illustrates perfectly what I'm trying to say here. A lot of times we GMs forget what it's like on the other side of the screen, even if we ourselves are players. And someone even said it in the Discord a couple of weeks ago. I can't remember what the conversation was or who said it, but someone was like, someone felt like an idiot because they were playing as a player and they were just doing stupid shit. Like, they were just, like, blundering around through the game world like a water buffalo pooping in a china shop. Okay, they're like, yeah, I felt so stupid. I'm a good game master, and I know what I'm doing. And yet, you know, I was just being an idiot. And it's like, well, the thing is, you don't realize when you're a game master and you have the whole world and all the knowledge all in your head, and you also can visualize what you're describing. Everything is super obvious to you. And even if you know that's true, you never realize how much more obvious it is. So, you know, when you switch to the other side of the screen and you're blundering around and you're like, man, I should have figured that out in the moment. That's not because you suddenly became stupid as a player. It's just because you forget how much less obvious things are on the other side of the screen. Right? And so we had a situation in my AD&D group where we are in an interlude where the players are not playing their characters, but they are in fact playing dwarves. It's a flashback because one of the characters in the group who is a dwarf is telling the story of the fall of his clan hold. His clan hold was invaded by orcs. It ties into the campaign story. And so I thought it would be really neat if instead of just having the player relate this story, I instead let him play his character 50 years prior and everybody else play one of his little dwarven friends, and they could actually play through the evacuation of the clan hold on the eve of war. Right? I thought that would be a really neat thing. And it was a really neat thing, though. It does put a lot of pressure on you because there's one character in there that you absolutely cannot let die, or you will time paradox your campaign out of existence. tricky. So, but anyway, so there is a situation. So they are wandering through these ruined halls because the clan hold used to be so much more populous and so much more magnificent. But over the millennia, the population has shrunk. They have abandoned these old lower halls. They have sealed them up, lest beasties, you know, get in there and invade. And, you know, like, it's just the ruins. Just like under a human city, there's ruins of the older cities. This dwarven clan hold has older clan hold underneath it. And so they are leading certain dwarven VIPs through these holds to a hidden, through these halls to a hidden exit, so that they can escape the coming war, right? So that's it, secret evacuation. So now they're wandering through these halls and they encounter, oh, we're also testing a totally new combat engine, but that's neither here nor there. I'll talk about that another time. I'll talk about that when I discuss the topic I bumped to share this story. So they're wandering around and, you know, they have like basic encounters with like rats, but they're different because, you know, I wanted to be neat. And also I wanted to set them up a little bit for disappointment. It's like, oh yeah, well, this is going to be so exciting. Yeah, well, now we're just fighting burrow rats, like stone digger rats. It's like, is this whole thing just going to be like, okay, since we're testing a new combat engine and we're first level dwarven evacuees, are you just going to make us fight like dwarven under versions of normal enemies? Like, oh no, it's under rats and deep spiders and oh, it's cave goblin, which I guess is just goblins. It's like the same lame ass shit. And it's like, so they're fighting the under rats. And they kill the under rats, although it gets pretty hairy, not because the rats are hairy, but because they keep getting ambushed and they're leading a caravan of non-combatants who are bearing like the two arcs of the Dwarvish Covenant with them because they're also taking a bunch of treasures with them. And then, bam, I hit them with a dragon. It's like, screw you, no more rats, now it's dragon time. Which, it wasn't really a dragon, it was a little fire drake, but they don't know that. It's like, you know, it seems like a dragon. So that was awesome. And also, for all the people who complain about, like, the deadliness of first, of, like, the older editions, I'd like to point out that, like, it is very rare, that I would, running a fifth edition game, I would say, you know what, I realize this creature is, like, a fifth level creature, and these are just first level idiots, but I'm gonna throw the fifth level monster at them, because, eh, what the hell? It'll probably, the numbers look like they'll work, honestly. And it did. So they, you know, they killed the dragon, yada, yada, yada. They're wandering along. They're very tense now because I have built up a lot of tension in this. And then they hear, as they're evacuating the dwarven halls, they hear the sounds of someone digging. Tink, 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 digging. Okay. So they send the dwarven rogue to scout, because the other thing I did to make this symbol was simple was I gave each of them a dwarf who had the same character class as the character they weren't playing. So the player who normally plays the cleric in the game was playing a dwarf cleric, and the player who normally plays a fighter in the game is playing a dwarf fighter, and the player who plays a wizard rogue is now playing a dwarf rogue, but not a wizard because dwarves can't wizard. Second edition. So they hear the sound, tink, 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 and they get really curious. And there's, so they go and they check it out. Because also they've been just checking out every side passage and every weird thing. Even though they are in this giant maze of halls and they're supposed to be evacuating quickly, they can't resist. If I put a mysterious thing, they can't say no. So they go and they check it out. And they find these short little earth elemental humanoids, about 4 feet tall, with rocky skin and crystalline hair, chipping away and digging, like pulling apart the dwarven walls and flagstone and stuff, and like salvaging the rocks and sniffing at it. And the dwarven scout, he hasn't heard, like... He snuck away from the party. He hasn't been heard. So he's just creeping up behind this this miner dude who is not doing anything, not even aware of them. And they've never seen creatures like these before. And that is when the player said to me something that completely caught me off guard. I backstab. Which is, this is not normally something my players will do. They do not just, they don't kill everything they encounter. And normally I'm very good at also telegraphing the kill. Like the first time they came upon an orc camp, it was really nasty. And the orcs were like cooking. They were butchering goats from a farm they'd burned down. And there was evidence that they were also eating, like the farmers were in their cook pots. And they were having the typical orcish conversation of, I sure do love being a cannibalistic evil humanoid that, you know, destroys everything but my own race, you know. So it was like, you know, if you just feel the need to go up and, you know, run these people through, it's fine. They're asking for it. But this was one of those situations where it's just in these completely abandoned halls that the dwarves have not been in for centuries, some strange elemental minor creatures have moved in and they're just pillaging it for raw materials. I kind of expected the group to try and make contact when they weren't instantly hostile. And it was like there was the situation was such that if they tried to make contact, they don't have a common language. These creatures couldn't speak common and they couldn't speak gravel or basalt or whatever language these creatures were speaking. But I did expect that there was going to be some pantomiming and some trying to make contact and whatever. And I even had that they were going to try and warn the party about some things if it was peaceful. And if it wasn't peaceful, they, because these earth elemental creatures are actually kind of powerful, that, you know, if it came to blows, they could do stone shape and wall of stone. And so they were just going to cut the party off from them and be like, nope, this is our territory. You go back the way you came. Just like, you know, just you're walled off because they're nonviolent, right? So it totally caught me by surprise when the player did go for the backstab. Because number one, he couldn't do any damage to the thing. The thing was made of rock. And then number two, it took its action. It turns around like, what the hell are you doing? It said in gravel, and then raised its pickaxe and swung, and I critted, and I have just introduced the combat and tactics optional rules to AD&D 2nd edition, which includes some impressive critical hit rules and tables that I was excited to use because they include such things as not just double damage, but also specific injuries. Like, say, having your chest crushed and having your lungs punctured and shit like that. So in that one move, I killed that character dead. Like, just it was one roll. You're dead. There is a tunnel through you. Okay. And, you know, I said at the end of the game, I'm like, I wasn't really expecting you to go for I backstab. I have to be honest, that caught me by surprise. That is nothing. The group has never done anything like that. And the guy, and I had a good laugh. And at the time, it's one of those stories where you're just kind of laughing at the player. You're like, what the hell were you thinking? There was nothing violent in this situation. You've never done anything like this before. You've been my player for years. You just suddenly went cold-blooded murder on completely innocent creature. The one time the creature is like so powerful that even without a critical hit, it could have killed you in two blows. And like, and you want to laugh, right? And you want to share that story with your game mastering friends. You'd be like, you'll never believe what my player did. But at the same time, as soon as you look at it from the other side of the table, like the thing is, as they were approaching the situation, they had already decided literally everything down here was hostile. Okay, because literally everything down here had already been hostile. And they have a bunch of innocents, basically innocent NPCs. And it's already, like, already one of the NPCs was killed. Another one broke his leg or twisted his leg or something. It was ugly very quickly. It has been a terrible day for these people. And they're talking about what the hell is that noise? And they're going to check it out because they're afraid if they don't check it out, whatever it is going to hear them and their caravan singing their hi-ho song, and, you know, jump them and try to steal their treasure and kill them. And they start talking, and they're talking up the idea that I bet it's kobolds. Kobolds are always doing shit like this. They're sneaking to mines. They've probably taken this over. It's kobolds. It's kobolds. It's kobolds. So by the time the rogue got close to one, he's like, holy shit, I have made all my stealth checks. The thing doesn't know I'm here. It's completely behind me. And because it seems so monstrous and alien, it's like, you know what? I have a chance to actually just end this threat in one go right now. It's the one time we can win. I am just going to run this thing through. And he tried, and he died, and then he discovered one of the reasons why there's 10 other dwarves in the caravan, because they basically are an extra life mechanic. Because I knew it was going to be brutal and that the escape was going to be partially about gradually picking off and seeing how many people survive. And this is not a spoiler, but just again to highlight the some of the game design thoughts here, because my players kind of know this already. It's like, when we get back to the present, they're going to go to where the dwarves have gathered, the refugee dwarves that did manage to survive the war 50 years ago. And whoever survives that ordeal in the prequel adventure will be present. And whoever died and whatever was lost in the prequel adventure will be lost. And that will change the tenor of their interactions with the dwarves. Now, they're not, like, the dwarves aren't going to be, hey, aren't you the person who was playing the character 50 years ago who got our queen killed? Not like that, but just like, It's now a different story, because they know what happened and they are affecting the outcome of the game. It's sort of a meta thing, but that extra life mechanic is, in a sense, determining what resources they'll have access to 50 years in the future and how the next chapter of the campaign might play out. So anyway, but my point is just, as I, you know, I have to try and find a balance when I'm telling the stories of my games, where I have to be charitable to my players because I have to remember everything is way more obvious to me. And also, I do have to make sure that if there's a story that I find particularly entertaining, that at the very least, the player who's player decisions might be called into question by telling the story is okay with being told the story. Also, as a side note, before I wrap this up and move on to Q&A with a twist, I do want to also add something. There are some of my players are in the Discord. Some of them are participants in chats. Some of them are participants in different channels. I have given my players the option of keeping their identities secret. Okay. That is, they do not, if they don't tell me it is okay to say, yes, that Discord user and supporter is one of my players, I will never ever reveal their identity. And part of that is because I don't want people asking them questions about how I run my games and what's going on and whatever. And, you know, I don't want them being bothered, but also because everybody has a right to privacy. And, like, I don't want to drag anybody's name up, as, you know, just for entertainment purposes. So I am going to ask everybody in the community, as I share these stories, absolutely under no circumstances should you ever try to guess who my players are or ask any user in the chat, hey, are you one of Angry's players? Or so who's actually played in one of Angry's games or whatever? Just leave them out of it. Okay. And I, meanwhile, I will clear the stories I can share and I will be happy to make it a regular feature if it is something that you think you'll all enjoy, to share some stories about how I'm running my home games and the terrible things I'm doing. And then we can all have a laugh at any players who agree to be laughed at. Okay. So with that said, we're going to move on to Q&A, and I'm doing Q&A a little bit differently this week or this month, this whatever. Okay. I opened up a thread for Q&A like a week ago, 2 weeks ago. It was a week ago. It was a week ago when I announced the date of this chat. And people started putting questions up, which actually gave me the ability to then go through and vet the questions and even, you know, be prepared to throw out some answers. And so I have chosen questions from the thread that I want to answer and have been prepared to answer them. I will address all of the questions I can. But I also put down a cutoff where I said, after this, these are questions I have not vetted in advance. If I have time for them and if I get to them, I will go into more the questions below the line, okay, below the cutoff. But that's a totally if time only. And so from now on, if you really want to make sure that your question has the best chance of getting answered, or if there's a topic you absolutely want me to discuss, the best thing to do is throw it in the thread in advance. I'm going to start opening the threads at least a week in advance, which gives you time to throw questions out. I'm also going to try and stay away from just give me gaming advice. Because, you know, people like to ask me, hey, I'm doing this thing, you know, what would you do or whatever. I'm going to stay away from that stuff. I do enough of that stuff on my site. So I'm trying to make sure to ask more interesting or answer more interesting questions. That said, if I don't choose to answer your question, it is not an indictment of you. Per se, it might be an indictment of you, but don't assume that, because it might also be for other reasons or time reasons or anything else. All right. So with that said, Mr. Producer, I have run 10 minutes over time on the beginning portion of my, on my first half spiel. So I am going to say that I need an extra 10 minutes added onto the end of the clock to make sure I get to the questions I have. And then if I have the time, I will then answer questions with the remaining time. So if you would give me an extra 10 minutes, see, that's why I had the stopwatch. It's not for you. It wasn't to replace you. It was to balance out me giving my yammering spiel with the Q&A portion. Okay, so we have an extra 10 minutes, and I'm just going to run through some questions. So first of all, Mendel, the complete monster, wants to know my thoughts on the video game Dredge, which I have recently played because it was available for free on the PlayStation Plus thingam. I have recently played it, and then I played it an entire second time, and it is one of the only two games in my entire video game. Actually, I think there might be three. There's two or three games in my entire history of ever that I have bothered getting all of the trophies to get the platinum trophy of you got all the other trophies. And Dredge turned out to be one of them. And he wants to know my thoughts on Dredge. Okay. So here's the thing. Dredge is not the game for me. And I knew that going into it. Okay. So if you don't know what Dredge is, by the way, Dredge is ostensibly a fishing game. You know that fishing mini game that all role-playing games have? All role-playing games and like life sim games and like all the Animal Crossings and Stardew Valleys and every Legend of Zelda and many, many role-playing games all have the fishing mini game. It is like, what if the game was the fishing mini game? It's fishing mini game the game. Ostensibly. It is also basically what I'm going to politely describe as a cosmic horror visual novel. Okay? So these are the two things. It is a cosmic horror visual novel interspersed with fishing minigames. Okay. This is why, by the way, it is not the game for me. Okay, all the story is delivered through menus. Like you have dialogues and you pick choices, and then this is how you get the story. And all the rest of the gameplay is tool around the map, do the fishing minigame, and then go back to town and do the crafting minigames. Which, they're not really crafting minigames, it's more sort of unlock things in the trees. Do the fishing minigames, unlock things in the trees, and occasionally take a break to have a menu-driven story. And also cosmic horror. Okay, there is nothing about that that is my jam. Okay, I'm sorry. That said, I did obsessively complete the game. Because, of course, like any game of this style, there is an encyclopedia of all the fishes, including the mutant fishes that you can find. Because you can find mutant fishes. And I don't want to give any spoilers. So far it's been fairly spoiler free. I've basically just described the mechanics. If what I've described is your jam, by all means play it, because if that description tells you I have to play this game, then it is the best version of that game you will ever get. I can objectively, categorically say that. It does fishing mini game, talent tree unlocking visual novel, the best of any game ever. Okay, I completed it because I was compelled to. Because there was an encyclopedia of fishes to complete, where you catch the fishes and then fills in a page in your encyclopedia. And when you have catched all the fishes, your encyclopedia is complete, and you get a trophy for, yay, you caught all the fishes, right? And yes, I know I just said caught as the past tense of catch, and I'm not sorry. You caught all the fishes, you get the encyclopedia, have a trophy, okay? I do not necessarily have to obsessively complete these things in every game. What happens is partway through the game, a calculation runs through my head. And the calculation is, am I close enough to doing this now that I actually feel I could complete it in whatever I'm going to define as a reasonable amount of time? And if my calculation of effort required to finish the encyclopedia is enough, it hits the right balance, it doesn't matter whether I'm enjoying the game, I still have to do it. Okay? Which is so, like, in Breath of the Wild, I did not have to find all the Korok seeds, but I did have to go to every shrine. And because I was so diligent about upgrading my armor and finding all the armor, by the way, I hit a point about halfway through the game where I'm like, it is actually in my reach that I could upgrade every suit of armor, max out every suit of armor. And so I had to, because my brain said I could. I didn't enjoy it. Breath of the Wild is not fun to max out all the armor in. In fact, for me personally, I feel I could stop that sentence at Breath of the Wild is not fun. But, okay, Alyssa's pointing out that explains why you finished Dredge once. Well, actually, this also explains why I finished Dredge twice. Because when all was said and done with Dredge, here is what happened. I had gotten 95% of the trophies. There were but two trophies that I did not earn. And so my brain did this calculation and said, Dredge wasn't that long a game. You know, it doesn't take that long. You could conceivably have all the trophies. And the other part of my brain was like, yeah, but, you know, it's Dredge. It's like, but you could finish it. Like, really finish it. Okay. There was another reason, too. Okay, and this is the other reason why I, I had to do a totally second playthrough of Dredge. And now I think I'm taking too long on one question. So this has already completely failed. Because I think I've now spent like 9 minutes on this question. Okay. Here's the other thing that happened. Is a third of the way through Dredge, I broke Dredge. Okay. There is an upgrade track where you can upgrade your fishing boat with better fishing gear and better engines and better shit and all this stuff. And then there's, you know, and there's actually two separate things. So there's a research track and then there's an upgrade track. Okay, yeah, this is the Demon Soul. Brussels is pointing out we've spent quite a bit on Dredge. And yes, this is now, Dredge is now the Demon Souls of the Angry Live Chat. Of course, 2 months ago, Demon Souls was the Demon Souls of the Angry Live Chat. It's fine. Nobody else gets a good answer. All the rest of the shit doesn't matter. Two of the answers are next month, and I'm the wrong guy to ask. So this is going to be easy from here. Okay. And one of them is just a sarcastic joke. Yes, Mendel is the Arthur of this live chat. I know it's only 8 questions. I'm going to need another 20 minutes. You only have power until I take it away. Anyway, okay. So I broke Dredge a third of the way through Dredge is the problem. Okay, because it is there's actually, it's divided into areas and it uses a light quest structure to bounce you from area to area. Okay, if you find that, or if you just start sailing around doing whatever, it works fine too. But there is a quest structure that actually leads you through the game. It is... To be fair, Dredge is a very well-designed game for what it is. Okay, it's just I don't understand why any human being would design a fishing mini-game visual novel upgrade tree the game based on cosmic horror. But if for some reason you got kicked in the head by a cow and decided that was a good project for your game design skills, Dredge is absolutely the best expression of it. It's really well put together. It's just an awful idea to play. It is something no human being should play. Of course, you might be thinking otherwise, in which case go play it. But anyway, so it bounces you from region to region. It uses quest structure really, really well. Okay. Now, here's the problem, though. I'm in the second area out of roughly 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah. I'm in the second area of 5. I haven't even finished the second quest line. And I'm looking at the upgrade tree, and I'm looking at what the traders sell and where the resources are available. And my brain does a calculation. It's like, you do realize you could complete this entire upgrade tree with just a few hours of work before you even leave this area, right? And so I had to. Because again, this is what my brain does. It's like, you could finish this off right now. You could have the totally souped up ship. Okay. So I did. And I'm really good at this shit. So I figured out the best engines based on tile space per speed increase per cost. And I figured out, I didn't sit down with like math. I'm not the woman in the meme with the math all flying in front of my head. Okay, I just kind of looked at it and I'm like, okay, that's definitely the most efficient engine setup right there. And then it's like, okay, which rods can I install so that no matter what, I will always be able to fish in any area I come across so that I never have to change my equipment loadout again? Got it. You know, what resources do I need? Where do they spawn? Okay, got it. Bam. 2 hours of work. My ship was maxed out. I was max level. After that, I didn't need money anymore. So I didn't need to fish anymore. And except I needed to fish precisely once in every fishing spot to fill the encyclopedia. And other than that, I just needed to do the quests. So there was no resource management. The other thing is that if you really soup up your engines, nothing can catch you because there are threats in the game. But you can just kind of outrun them. You just tool past them. Just goodbye, Cthulhu monster. And that was it. So, what was the question? Oh, right. The question was why. Right. Alyssa is saying that's not a fun way to play the game. It certainly was not. The problem was I didn't realize how unfun it would be until I already did it and my brain was working against me. So, and yes, I did. I optimized the fun right out of the game. Except, I'm going to blame the game a little because it really wasn't that hard to do. Okay? If you want to break, the only reason I did it is because I looked at the time commitment it would take and I'm like, I could bang this out in an hour. In an hour of just tooling around, I figured out this game systems, the upgrade paths. It's all very simple and obvious. And the rarest resources in the game that you need to upgrade, the trader also has some of them available for sale every time you reload the game. Not that I did save scumming, but I did notice that if you just kept buying them every time they were available, you'd have everything. So I do blame the game a little bit for being too easy to break. But I'm not going to hold that against it because I do think the game is really well designed. But that is also why I needed a second playthrough. Because I'm like, okay, if I didn't do that shit, would the game be more fun? I was just curious what the gameplay experience would actually be like if I didn't, you know, upgrade absolutely everything. If I had limited resources, limited money, if I only upgraded the things I needed as I needed them and, you know, didn't grind money and buy huge numbers of resources to just do the whole thing. So I was just curious. So that is the other reason why it deserved a second playthrough. The second playthrough was actually a critical analysis playthrough. It was also my stupid brain saying, hey, you only need 2 trophies and then you could say you really beat this game. Okay, but it does mean that I am probably the most qualified person to issue an opinion on Dredge of any human being on the internet now, because in the span of a single weekend, I played the entirety of it through twice, got every trophy, and literally broke the game, and then had to play it again with my hands tied behind my back to unbreak it. So, all of that said, it is an absolutely wonderful game for anybody but me to play. And if you are at all a completionist or an optimizer, stay the hell away from it because you're going to break the game in 10 minutes and then it's just not going to be fun. Also, the story, I'm not going to do story spoilers, but personally I found the story was nothing to write home about. It was a fairly standard cosmic horror plot. Once you know what's going on, it's like, yeah, okay. I've read a few Lovecraft books. This is not breaking new ground here. But then again, okay, so moving on. So that was question one. Question two. October Foundry would like to know my opinion of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplaying. So here's the thing. I have been promising a review of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, and I have been promising a review of AD&D 2nd Edition. Tonight, after I finished talking about why I couldn't tell stories about my campaign, I was going to give my review of AD&D 2nd Edition, and then I was going to say, next month I'll do the Warhammer Fantasy thing. But now it's going to be, next month I'll do the AD&D 2nd Edition review, and then the following month I'll do the Warhammer review. So there. See, I just banged out a question in, what, 45 seconds? Okay. Guy Quail wants to know what good things do I think are good about Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door, because I did also buy the remake of that and I did start replaying it and I got halfway through and then stopped and lost interest. And also Dredge happened, but then I never felt like I needed to go back to Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door. I'm not going to give a whole description of what Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door is or give a complete review. I'm just going to limit myself to the question here. What are the good things about Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door? Number one, the writing is top notch, kind of. Okay, the writing is really good. It's clever, it's witty, it's snappy, it's fun. You know, it's a delight to read all the dialogues and stuff. Once upon a time, anyway, because in replaying it, one of the things that I found is that it's actually also really, really wordy. Where I say that the dialogue is witty and it's, you know, all of the writing is good and it's witty, it's also a little overwrought. It's also a little repetitive. It's also a little dense. And that's ultimately kind of what petered me out about it, is like, the best part of the game is reading the text boxes, but man, there's a lot of them. The other good thing about Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door is that it manages to make turn-based combat really, really interesting in a number of ways. And I don't just mean the action commands. Everybody's like, oh, yeah, action commands. Okay, there's a lot going on in Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door's combat system, including the customizable badge options, including sight reading the enemies. Say, oh, this guy's got a spike on his head. I can't use my jump. And this guy's armored. I can't use my hammer. And this, or if this guy's got a high, like, there's differentiation in kind between the attacks. If you use your jump attack is two hits on the enemy. But if the enemy has a defense score, its defense is subtracted from your jump twice. So, and because you're leveling up your jumps and your hammers and your different badge combinations and what have you, you end up with all these interesting little decisions. Like, if I jump on the enemy, his defense is gonna count twice, but at the same time, my stomp is my most powerful attack, and I have this badge that increases my attack damage on all my attacks, which doubles up on my stomp. And so there's a lot of depth in the little bit of the system. And then there's always the fun little surprises where, like, at random, audience members are throwing things at your characters, or sometimes the set will just fall down. And there's certain attacks that do occasionally knock down bits of the set, which can damage you or damage the enemies. So it does a lot to make turn-based combat interesting, which is something that is really, really difficult to do. And so I really enjoy that a lot. But at the end of the day, I don't know whether it's just a different time in my life and my taste in games has changed, or whether it's really good once, but in the end, the good writing was kind of weighing on it, and the turn-based combat is interesting, but it's still just turn-based combat, and I could be playing something far more interesting like Dredge for 12 hours. Okay, Ralphie has asked me, can I recommend any high-level modules? No, I cannot. I'm going to stop. So I have this tendency to answer questions I shouldn't answer. People are always asking me for recommendations for modules. I don't run modules. I don't even read modules anymore. Occasionally, I will pick up a module if people are saying interesting things and leaf through it. But I don't run modules. I write my own material. And so I am the wrong guy to ask for module recommendations, especially higher level games, because now you're asking for a product I don't use for a mode of play that I wouldn't touch with an 11-foot pole, because high-level play sucks, the end. Okay, Boro. I'm blitzing through this now, right? Right, am I? I'm doing better. Probably only have 8 minutes left to get through the rest of the questions, which is a shame because they're going to be fun, so I'm going to need more time, and then I'm going to have a fight with Procellus because I at least have to get through the remainder of the questions that I wrote down. That seems only fair. All right, if I promise to stay focused, you have to let me get through the list. All right? That seems like a fine. Procellus, fine, fine, fine. We're going to yell at each other later. He's really a good producer because he's a hard ass, which is funny because he's gelatinous. He's a Metroid, like he's literally a space jellyfish. That wasn't like a fat joke. Okay. So he's literally a blob of, I promise I'll stay focused. Okay. So Ralph, yes, I know this is not focus. Whoa. How did you even do the big text all caps thing? Wow. Okay. Is there a markup I don't know in Discord? Anyway, Boro. He's asking me, have I cooked any recent good meals? And he wants to know when I'm going to be doing a cooking stream. Okay. Because he really enjoys hearing about stuff I cook, which is actually kind of gratifying. Okay. I get asked a lot about my cooking because I talk a lot about my cooking, or else I used to talk a lot more about my cooking than I do. I only occasionally talk about my cooking now. I'm not a good cook. I will never claim to be a good cook. Mostly what I do is I find recipes I like, I add them to my binder, and occasionally I fiddle with them. So that's it. I'm good at finding recipes and I'm good at following directions. I am also good at kind of creatively throwing things together. I'm an okay cook. And I was never much of a cook in my life. until 12 years ago when I ended up hospitalized with diabetes and the high blood pressure. And the doctors basically said, change your diet or you're going to die. And that's when I discovered that, well, obviously I didn't want to die. That was the, I discovered I didn't want to die. I had never realized that about myself, but actually I have a survival instinct. It turns out that was a big revelation. But the other thing was that I actually discovered that food kind of tastes better if you cook it yourself. It's also cheaper to cook yourself, especially if you just go to the grocery store and get the ingredients. And especially if you're smart about how you plan out your ingredients and make good use of leftovers and buy ingredients that you can use for multiple meals and stuff. So it kind of fit my lifestyle because I like planning and food tastes better when you cook it yourself. It's become really hard for me to cook lately. I haven't been talking so much about my cooking because one of the things I really enjoyed over the last several years was cooking for Allie and myself. I was the cook. I did all of the cooking, which sometimes led to some conflict, actually, because things were a little uneven there. But nonetheless, I got really, really used to cooking for two, and it's nice. And now cooking for myself is a reminder that I'm eating all my meals alone again. So it's sad. It is bittersweet. But I have been getting back into cooking now. And by the way, the main reason why I wouldn't be doing a cooking stream, apart from the fact that I'm not great at it, and I do occasionally injure myself, so there would be blood and burns. It's also because I'm basically just searching around, stealing recipes, and then just putting them together. And also, my technique is terrible. you have to see me cut anything. It is awful. It comes out cut. It comes out okay. But, like, it's totally because I'm terrible. I'm, like, the opposite of a cooking show. Despite all of my failings, I managed to make a decent meal. That is how I would describe my cooking. Despite my copious obstacles and clear deficiencies in the kitchen, I do somehow manage to produce a decent meal. Okay. So, but it has become a little bit hard to cook for myself lately. That said, I will share two things that I have cooked this past week that I am particularly proud of. One, this weekend, I made a very simple slow cooker Mississippi pot roast for myself, which is delightful because you get three meals out of even a small roast if you make it for yourself. And that's a really simple thing to do because you just throw the roast, whatever meat you want. I actually go out of my way to buy a little bit nicer cut of meat and also a leaner cut of meat for health reasons. So I usually go with a sirloin. But you know, use whatever you want. A chuck roast, perfectly fine. You throw that in the slow cooker. You throw like a packet of ranch dressing powder, the ranch dressing mix, and a packet of au jus gravy mix in there. Throw them all in. I like to use the low sodium stuff if I can. And then you take about a half cup of brine from a jar of pepperoncini. You pour it in there. You can throw some butter on top. I don't use too much of it, but you throw a little bit of unsalted butter just on top of the roast. And then you just dot a dozen little pepperoncinis around the thing. Pop it in. Cook it on low for 8 hours, and bam, you have a wonderful Mississippi pot roast. It is very good, very simple. You come home 8 hours later, there it is. The other thing I made, because I happened to have chicken leftover, was I made myself taquitos in the air fryer. So I just mixed the chicken together with some sour cream and some leftover salsa that I had for snacking on and some shredded cheese that I had left over from my omelets for lunch. So this was all just thrown together with leftovers. The only thing I actually had to purposely buy was the corn tortillas. And then you just warm up the corn tortillas in a pan. You throw the fajita mix in there, wrap them up together. And then I think I ended up doing what, like 370 degrees in the air fryer, 6 minutes, and then flip them, and then another 6 minutes, and perfect. Perfect little crispy, delicious taquitos. You can dip them in sour cream, dip them in salsa. And because I had a bunch of sliced peppers and onions from, again, omelet day, because every Saturday morning is omelet day. I had leftover fajita leftover vegetables. I threw them in a pan, sauteed them with some nonstick cooking spray so that I didn't have to use oil, a little bit of salt and pepper on the top and some taco seasoning, and bam, I had taquito vegetables. So those are two things I made this week that I particularly enjoyed. Feel free to replicate either one. Jinbei Fong, this is question number six for those keeping score at home. And Jinbei Fong is asking, what is my favorite donut? Because I have been mentioning donuts a lot because I have been eating my stress, which I don't recommend that. Don't do it. And it's kind of funny to come off the whole, I got diabetes and I had to learn how to cook, so I didn't die. Now I'm stress eating donuts. But I'm being very good about that now. I'm better on that. But what is my favorite donut? So, my favorite donut is the Boston Cream Donut, but this requires explanation, apparently, which I never would have realized before I moved away from my hometown, because where I grew up on Long Island in New York, which is a very dense suburb of New York City, the only place to get donuts was Dunkin' Donuts. I mean, they're like grocery store bakery. So there were other donuts available, but it was always Dunkin' Donuts. That's where I got my donut. And so what Dunkin' Donuts calls a Boston cream donut is a fried donut, or like, it's not a cake donut. It's, I know they don't necessarily fry their donuts, but it's that fluffy donut batter that gets all airy and light, because I hate cake donuts. Cake donuts can fuck right off. Okay, no, it's you need a real fried donut, a yeast donut, like right there. It's a yeast ring type donut, except it's not a ring. It's a solid mass. It's a solid, it's basically shaped like a tuna can, right? And then it's injected with custard, and then there is chocolate icing spread over the top, and sometimes sprinkles. And in Dunkin' Donuts, they will change the sprinkles depending on the season. They changed the colors of the sprinkles, which I always thought was a fun touch. I don't know if Dunkin' Donuts does that anymore, because I moved to a town here in Wisconsin that does not actually have a Dunkin' Donuts, and I had to go elsewhere for my donut cravings, and discovered things like Quick Trips and also grocery store bakery counters. That is when I discovered that the term Boston cream is not universal, and that you could be getting different things, or sometimes you won't even see something labeled Boston cream donut, because this is where I discovered that here in Wisconsin and maybe elsewhere, they do not refer to a donut that does not have a hole in it as a donut. To be a donut, it must be a ring. It must have a hole in it. And then you got your Dunkin' Donuts, and you got your yeast ring donuts is what Meyer calls the ones I like. And then you got your cake donuts. Yeah, it's a whole thing. Okay, if it's a solid mass of donut matter, it is either called a Persian or a Bismarck, apparently. And this may be true elsewhere in the world, but I had never experienced it before I moved outside of Dunkin' Donuts for my donut knowledge. Okay, then the other problem is that they will refer to Boston cream or Bavarian cream or cream-filled Bismarck or whatever. Sometimes they will use those terms, and what you will end up getting is a cream and not a custard. And so there was a great deal of disappointment as I was trying to disentangle the new terminology to get the donut that I wanted. Alyssa's insisting this is a Quick Trip thing, but I have also encountered the same problem in Festival and Meijer. So I'm now thinking of it. This is just a universal Wisconsin thing. Wisconsin is just stupid about donuts. Sorry. Okay, Wisconsin just doesn't know what donuts are. They're all donuts. You don't have to call a Persian or a Bismarck just because it's solid. But this is the other confusing thing, is that a Persian is a solid mass of donut with no hole, whereas a Bismarck has filling. So if you buy anything that is a Persian, you are just getting too much donut, is the problem. It's just not right to eat. And then there was the whole cream custard confusion. So my love for Boston cream donuts led to months of heartbreak out here, because we didn't have a Dunkin' Donuts at the time when I moved to this town. And I didn't know what the Wisconsin term for what I wanted was. And that is the end of my donut story. Misspelled Kate. Though I'm pretty sure that they will insist that Kate is pronounced cat, like Kate Sith. Yeah, even Arizona can do Boston cream right. Yeah, but it melts before you can... Like, the icing just melts into a liquid, so you can't enjoy it. But yes. Misspelled Kate would like to know, what is my favorite NPC in Demon's Souls? And I read this question, and I'm like, there's NPCs in Demon's Souls? Because the NPC... And I say that facetious, and I don't want to get into another Demon's Souls thing. But the NPCs in Demon's Souls are so friggin' insubstantial. They're just there for like one line of dialogue between every level you do. They're otherwise just worthless. And like, I did not actually find the story in Demon's Souls that engaging. It was like, oh, there was a demon and it eats souls and then it woke up and now put it back to sleep because civilization is stupid and keeps waking it up. And maybe even the divine people are worshiping the same demon. Who's to know? Demon, who's to know? Okay, but if it did hold me down and force me to pick a favorite NPC, it would, of course, be Prince Alan Ostrava of Boletaria. I think that was his name, Alan Ostrava of Boletaria, because he's the only NPC that actually does... that's not true, because there's also the knight, the gruff knight, who will come beat a boss for you if you do it right. But I like him just because he's sort of like... He's sort of the Solaire slash Siegmeier of Demon Souls, in that he's sort of this bumbling character who's going through the adventure with you, but he can't do it right. Also, I found out when I had to look up his name to discover that it's actually not Alan Ostrava, but I don't care, is that his actual name is Ariona. Like, Ostrava is not... His name in the game is Ostrava Alant, except it's not. It's actually Ariona. Because... And that's it. Like, apparently, this is a big thing. And the Gruff Knight will tell you that, oh, his real name is actually Ariona. Or just refer to him as Ariona. Like, this is a big reveal. As, like, the same... Like, remember in Star Trek Into Darkness, where they captured John Harrison or whatever. And then he's like, or John Harrodin or whatever the hell his name is. And then they have him in prison and he's talking to Kirk and Spock. He's like, actually, my name is Khan. And it's a reveal for the audience because, oh my God, it's Khan. But like Kirk and Spock, like they don't know who Khan is because the backstory isn't there, which kind of makes redoing Wrath of Khan just not work. So it's just like, they're just kind of staring at him like, and then Spock's like, yeah, okay, I'll make note of your proper appellation in my log. Like, so it was like one of those reveals where it's just, oh, okay. Oh, so his, oh, you know what it was? Okay. This is funny. I'm going to tell a funny story from a long time ago because I'm staying focused and I only have one more question after this. So it's okay. Okay. Before Wolverine Origins came out, remember when they did the X-Men Origins and they did Wolverine Origins and it was terrible because they made Deadpool, they sewed Deadpool's mouth shut, and that became the thing. Okay, so before it came out, before we knew it was terrible, a friend of ours and I, we were really excited to go see Wolverine Origins. It's like, because we had enjoyed the X-Men movies up to that point. We're like, oh, this is going to be awesome. We're going to go see it. And my one friend who's a bit of a comic book geek, he was excited because he's like, you know what? They're going to reveal in the movie. I read that they're going to reveal in the movie that Wolverine's claws are not actually adamantium or adamantine or adamant or whatever. And I'm like, what? It's like, yeah, no, he's got bone claws. That's his thing. And then they're just coated with adamantium because his skeleton was coated with adamantium. And I'm like, oh. I thought his mutant power was regeneration. It's like, yeah, that too. But his mutant power is also, he has bone claws that got coated with adamantium. So they're going to show us that his claws are actually bone. And then they get covered. We're going to see his real claws. And he's like super excited about it. Like it's going to be this big thing. And other people were really excited about it too. Like Kate, misspelled Kate is saying this sounds like needlessly complex, but yes, it's based on a Marvel comic, so it's needlessly complex. So, but it was suddenly a big thing. Like, oh my God, we're going to see Wolverine's real claws for the first time in a movie. And I'm like, what is the point of this reveal? Like, it changes nothing about the character or his claws or whatever. And so, we're talking about it. I said, so, you know, what is the point of this? Because it's like, so Wolverine's there. It's like, hey, Wolverine, did you know your claws are actually bone and they're just covered with adamantium? And then Wolverine just, he looks at his claws. He turns his arms back and forth and looks them over. And he goes, huh. And then he shrugs. Because that's it. That's all that reveal needs is just, huh, a shrug. And so, amongst my two cousins and I, the phrase Wolverine claws reveal entered our lexicon for a detail that is revealed in a movie or piece of media that is played as a big revelation that is super important, but at the end of the day is really worthy of only looking at and saying, huh, shrugging and moving on. And so when I discovered that Prince Alan Ostrava's name is actually Ariona, and the Demon Souls wiki is like, here's an interesting fact. His name is actually Ariona, but who the hell is Ariona and what does that mean? Because who the hell even is Prince Alan Ostrava? And it's not like there's anything else in the game that's like, oh, the Ariona family is actually different from the Ostrava family. And that means he's adopted and he's actually, like, there's, it goes nowhere. It's just, that's his name. His name is a different name than the one he has. Does that mean anything? No. It's a Wolverine claws reveal. It's, huh. So anyway, that is my favorite NPC in Demon Souls. And finally, Mendel again has a question because I'm staying focused. Getting through all of these. Mendel has noted that I have been rereading the Song of Ice and Fire series and asks if I have any thoughts. Actually, what he asked was, how have you found it? And I was instantly tempted to just say, I just walked over to my bookshelf. It's right there because I keep my books in alphabetical order, like by author, like a normal human. But honestly, on reread, I am discovering that the final two books in the current series, Storm of Crows, Feast of Crows and Dance of Dragons, or whatever the hell they are, books 4 and 5, are actually, number one, I didn't really remember them. Like, they just sort of went out of my head. I loved the first three books. Okay. My favorite book, by the way, is 2. I know everybody loves 3. Like, oh, you know, Red Wedding, Purple Wedding, all the weddings. Yeah, you know, like, and yes, 3 is an awesome book, and 3 is the book where he first, like, starts actually building the real history of the world. That's where you first start getting the inklings of the history of the world, though more so in 4 and 5. I completely forgot books 4 and 5, and I had only read them once before. And I'm discovering now, because I just started book 5, why that is. And that is because they are books wherein very little happens and there are no climaxes. Where it is just the characters are most, except for Cersei's story. The most interesting story in both of those books is Cersei's story, which is a shame because I absolutely hate Cersei. And like, not just hate, like, oh, she's a bad character and or she's a bad person and you're supposed to hate her. But I hate her in that I do not find her a compelling character. Like, I do not find it rewarding to be in her head and find out how she thinks, because it is just, she is just a reprehensible, delusional idiot. She is the stupidest character in that series after Caitlyn, who was also the stupidest character in that series. And I mean, that series has a lot of stupid characters, but Caitlyn and Cersei pretty much, they caused every problem as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, I mean, Robert was, anyway, so I don't want to get into that. Okay. There is, so mostly what happens in those books is characters wandering around the world and then having other characters share interesting bits of history with them. Like, so like Brienne's story is entirely, she's just wandering around the Crownlands and up into the Riverlands hunting for Sansa, but most of what actually happens to her is she comes to this interesting place, and then she learns about the history of the Whispering Castle, and she comes to this place, and she learns about the Blackfyre Rebellion, and she comes to this place, and then she learns about this and that. There are like two interesting events that happen in Brienne's whole story, which might seem like enough, but then when you look back at all the things that happened in each of the previous books and how loaded they were with plot points and actual developments, it's like, yeah, no wonder this shit didn't stick in my head. It's mostly just the characters going on a walking tour of Westeros so that we can learn the giant complicated history of every minor little castle and province. And as much as I enjoy a bit of backstory, that's all it was. And like, now we're into Dance of Dragons, and that's Tyrion's entire friggin' story is just a tour of Essos and all the history of that, you know, punctuated by occasional, oh, and then for a minute this happens, you know? Even Bran's story, which is really great in Dance with Dragons, like all of the interesting shit that happens to Bran happens in one chapter. He is only in Ravenface's cave, Brynden Rivers, whatever the hell his name is. Raven, Three-Eyed Crow, Raven Beak. I can't remember his name. He's only in his cave for like one chapter. The rest of the time is just he's wandering around the north. And it's like, and then it's building up to like three or four different wars or battles that all don't happen in these books. So what I realized is the reason it's so frustrating waiting for Winds of Winter is because we're actually waiting for the sequel to A Storm for Swords or Storm of Swords. We're waiting for the sequel to the third book to be finished. That said, it is awesome that finally we can say categorically that Winds of Winter is definitely coming out because all of the signs are there and I am super excited for it. Unlike every previous time where the signs have not been there. And then soon thereafter, we will absolutely, definitely be playing Silk Song. And with that, I am going to bid you all good night. Thank you, Procellus, for producing and putting up with the numerous extensions to the time. Though, to be fair, I did ask for an extra 10 minutes, and then I only rambled for another extra 20 minutes beyond that. So it was another 90-minute podcast. So thank you for that. Thank you for everybody who asked questions. And, you know, to my players, I apologize for poking fun at you and for promising to continue to poke fun at you going into the future. So take care all and good night.